This is Terrence McNally. I've been doing this show for quite a while before joining Progressive Voices. And this week I'm going to share with you one of my favorite previously recorded interviews. It's with Elaine Pagels on her book Revelations. The book of Revelations, which is actually quite controversial among biblical scholars, has been the source of a great deal of the theocratic rites, vision, and politics. And she looks at what Revelations is, what it said, and how it really relates to the rest of the Bible. This interview originally aired in January 2013. We hear a lot these days about Armageddon, the apocalypse, the rapture, end times. More than just a current cultural phenomenon, these ideas appear to be a persuasive motivating force for millions of Americans. These words are in our everyday vocabulary, and as metaphors, they show up all over the map. Example, Carmageddon is the nickname for the I-405's weekend closure in July 2011. But where do they come from? Well, as many of you know, they come from the book of Revelation, the last book of the Christian New Testament. But how did they get there? Who wrote it? What does it mean? This week's guest, religious scholar Elaine Pagels, author of the Gnostic Gospels, considers the book of Revelation to be wartime literature. She points out that it was written by a Jew following Rome's resounding defeat of a Jewish uprising, and she interprets it as an attack on the decadence of the empire. Soon, however, a new sect, known as Christians, seized on it as a weapon against heresy and infidels of all kinds. And I believe that weapon is still alive today in American culture and politics. Pagel says she found herself, as she wrote this book, investigating the very theory that throughout history, the powerful have sought to force God's enemies to submit or face death, good versus evil. We'll talk about Revelations, but we're also going to talk about the Gnostic Gospels and the over 50 texts discovered, hidden, and preserved in Nag Hammadi, Egypt in 1945, and about the impact of politics and culture on religion, highlighted by the moment when Constantine converted to the Church of Rome. Christianity went from being the religion of outsiders and freethinkers to being the religion of the empire. And we'll talk about how all of this plays out today in politics and conflict, both in the U.S. and around the world. Here in Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, religion. It's all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Elaine Pagels is credited with changing our historical image of Christianity by exploding the myth of a unified early church. She's professor of religion at Princeton University, where she's taught since 1982. Pagels has been awarded Rockefeller, Guggenheim, and MacArthur Fellowships. After earning a BA in history and an MA in classical studies at Stanford, and briefly studying dance at Martha Graham's studio, she earned her PhD at Harvard, where she was part of the team studying the Nag Hammadi scrolls. Those found, as I said, in 1945 that shed light on early Christian debates on theology and practice. Her best-selling Gnostic Gospels, analyzing early Christian manuscripts, won both the National Book Critics Circle Award and the National Book Award. Her other books include The Origins of Satan, Adam, Eve, and the Serpent, Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas, Reading Judas, and her latest, Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. Welcome again, Elaine Pagels, to Free Forum.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I actually, in doing research for this, found out that we haven't done this in about 10 years, which
is That's true.
It's hard to believe. It was just on the release of Beyond Belief.
Yes, that's right, when I was visiting.
Yeah.
Yes.
So as I always say, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So tell us a bit about your path to the work that you're doing today. Feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moment of decision. How did you end up as a religious scholar, and how did your working career become so entwined with the Nag Hammadi scrolls?
Well, those are good questions, Terrence. I mean, first of all, it was very unlikely because when I went, you know, I mean, they don't teach this stuff in high school or school, and my family wasn't religious particularly. They were sort of culturally Protestant. My father had given it all up for Darwin. He became a biologist, and his attitude was that, you know, the Bible was a bunch of, you know, weird old folk tales, which people who weren't educated, you know, might still look at. But, you know, he was a scientist and really had no use for that. So I was brought up to think that when people got educated enough, religion would just sort of fade away, you know. And then, but I loved poetry, I loved dance, I loved music, you know. And then some friends took me to an evangelical revival in San Francisco. I think it was Billy Graham. I was in high school. It was at the Cow Palace in San Francisco.
Wow.
And it was huge. And you know, to my parents' total horror, I fell right in. I just loved it. I loved the music and the intensity and the passion of the whole thing. They were truly horrified. And so for about a year, I participated in a Bible church, which was, you know, Bible-believing, and this is what the Bible says. And it was a very transformative experience because there was a world of imagination and life and there that I just had no idea existed, you know. So, and then after a year, I fell out of love with it because they start telling you exactly how to live your life and who you can be friends with and who's going to hell, and including one of my closest friends because he was a Jew, and I thought that was odd because Jesus was a Jew, but that didn't seem to affect them. So, you know, so I left, and I, you know, I left that church, and then I, you know, I got into dance and other things and many other things, and was going to do that. And after I realized I was a pretty good dancer, but not good enough to do that in New York, you know, without basically waiting on tables the rest of my life, I realized there was something I was very deeply curious about, which is why hasn't religion just gone away? Why is it still around? Why is it still an issue in the world? And, of course, they didn't teach it in college where I went to college at Stanford. There was no department of religion. I mean, it wasn't something you could study. But there were some places you could. And I didn't want to get brainwashed, so I didn't go to a religious school. But Harvard had a PhD program in the study of religion, and people studied Judaism, and they studied Hinduism, and a few studied Christianity. So I thought, well, okay, maybe I could find out what it was about that experience that was so powerful. And I went to see if I could find out, you know, what did Jesus really say, and what was it, what really happened? And I thought I could get closer to it by reading Greek and reading the New Testament. And then I got there, and these professors of New Testament were reading Gospels I had never heard of, like the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. And you think, what is going on here? And it was a huge detective story because really those hadn't been published at all.
And about what time is this? Because as I pointed out, they were discovered in 45. And at what point are you arriving at Harvard and finding?
Well, this is, yeah, you're right. This is in the 70s because this was kept secret by certain scholars, the way the Dead Sea Scrolls were. The Dead Sea Scrolls were found in the 1940s. But there was a scholar at the Hebrew University, whom I will not name, who simply kept all he could, wouldn't let any other scholar either at the Hebrew University or Harvard or anywhere look at it because it was his private sort of preserve. Because, you know, people wanted to be famous by publishing this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So this was very secret. And finally, an American scholar, James Robinson in Claremont, California, put everything, got UNESCO actually to put it on, I was going to say the internet, but that didn't exist, but put it on microfilm and
right,
publish it. So he did that, and then we all had access to it, and scholars all over the world did, and we found there are over 50 writings and quite a few secret gospels that were ancient. I mean, they were written, we don't know exactly when, late 1st century, 2nd century, but about as early as the others. But we'd never heard about them except that they were heretical.
Let me cut in for just 1 second to let people know that they're listening to a Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally, and the voice you hear is Elaine Pagels. She's the award-winning author of the Gnostic Gospels and several other popular and highly regarded books on the history of religion. We're going to talk about her newest book, Revelations, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. But we're also going to talk about the whole big context in which that happens. And right now she's telling us about her early study when she discovered that others had discovered hidden gospels. So the point at which, the point in the early 70s is when they're just sort of bursting in the academic world.
Yes, and they were all stamped, you know, completely private, do not reproduce, and, you know, these are written in, originally, Terrence, they were written in Greek, like the New Testament, but those had all been destroyed by the bishops thousands of years ago. So the only copies that survive were translated into the language of Egypt. It was really the language of hieroglyphs, but it's written in a script that looks like a cross between Greek and Russian, Coptic. And the Coptic Christians had taken this stuff and were reading it in monasteries, but when the bishops banned it, somebody defied the order to destroy this stuff because it was heresy, and buried it to preserve it in a jar in a burial cave thousands of years old in Upper Egypt near Luxor. And that's where an Egyptian farmer sort of stumbled across it in 1945.
And all he knew was that he'd found some jars with scrolls in them, but it looked like old stuff, right?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, they weren't even scrolls. They were papyrus books, papyrus leaves, you know, really books, but they're so brittle that when you touch them, they practically disintegrate because it's very dry. Papyrus usually rots, but in that part of Egypt, it's so dry that some of them survived, you know. And so he didn't know what he'd found, and he tried to sell it on the black market. That was illegal. So, and then he went to jail because he and his brothers had killed an enemy of their father who'd killed their father in a blood feud. These blood feuds were going on even when we were in Upper Egypt in the 70s, machine guns shooting across the road to Luxor, actually. But anyway, he found this stuff, and when it finally got to the Coptic Museum, where it now is in Cairo, scholars began to find out that there was something amazing here. There were sayings of Jesus that we'd never heard, and a lot that we had heard, and many secret gospels and other writings attributed to Jesus and his disciples. So that's what's really changed our picture.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't what I wrote. It was what came out of that amazing discovery. We're still trying to sort of sort it out.
I understand, yeah. In other words, you happened to hit with that book, that best-selling book. The discovery then became more well-known than it had been. So let me just ask a couple of quick questions. Have they all been translated, and are they fairly universally accepted for what you and other scholars have stated them to be?
First, they've all been translated, yes. And that actually, I mean, we did a quickie job that was published in 1977 called the Nag Hammadi Library in English, and then we did a scholarly job that took until 2005. We finally finished really beautiful scholarly publications in Coptic and English and notes and stuff that were published. No, not everybody agrees what they are. And anyway, it's a pretty disparate collection. Some of these writings are pretty early. We think written, say, we don't know, the end of the first century, maybe the year 90, when some of the New Testament writings were finished. Some of them may be later. But there's a lot of argument now, Terrence, now that conservative scholars can't just say, well, they're just crazy because they're not the real Gospels. Now some, for example, at Cambridge University, there's a scholar who says, well, all right, they are ancient Christian texts, but they're terrible. And they really don't count and just don't pay any attention, you know. But the rest of us who are working on them are saying, you know, this really expands our picture. Because before this, what got preserved of the Christian movement was a kind of small slice of what there really was. And that's what happened to accord with later tradition that called itself Orthodox. But now we know there was a lot more controversy, discussion. Who was Jesus? What was the good news? What does the kingdom of God mean? Who are the real disciples? What is the right message of Jesus? All of those arguments, I mean, all of those questions were intensely debated. And a lot of those debates were just simply censored.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying censored not since the 70s, but censored or since the 70s? You're saying both in the early days and since?
They were censored in the 4th century
yes.
when the bishops actually had police and military power backing up their orders.
Right. Now, since we're talking right now about these books, which end up being sort of the window into everything else that we might talk about as we look at any of your books, and including the recent one in the Book of Revelation, for those of us to whom this is new, and it was new when I first started reading you years ago, a couple of historical questions. One, you've mentioned two or three times that these are very early. They're written in the year 90 or the first century or something. So place for us the first, the accepted Gospels, you know, that everyone knows, John, Matthew, Mark, Luke. When were those written? Who were those written by? And then that moment when Christianity goes from being, as I mentioned in the intro, from being the religion of outsiders, truth seekers, questioners, to being the religion of the empire. And then it's soon after that, isn't it, that these decisions get made about what stays in and what goes out. So
exactly right. Yes. What's fascinating, actually, is, as you point out, that there was a Christian movement for about 300 years before we had a canon of the New Testament, which means a list of writings that are the right ones to read and worship. So there were lots and lots of writings in the early Christian movement, and the ones we know best in the New Testament, we think the Gospel of Mark is the earliest of those, probably written around the year 70. That's about, 30 years after the death of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew and Luke, we think, are written about 10 years later just because of the internal references. But we can't, you know, there are no dates on the manuscripts because the earliest ones don't survive. The Gospel of John, probably written around the year 90 to 100. That's what we think. Now, some people thought one of the texts found in this new collection might be even earlier, and that's the one called the Gospel of Thomas, just because scholars had said, you know, before anybody wrote the Gospels that have stories and sayings of Jesus, like the ones in the New Testament, the people who did had lists of sayings of Jesus, and they had lists of what Jesus did, you know. They had written sources, and we didn't have a written source of the sayings of Jesus, but the Gospel of Thomas is exactly that, and it has, it's just about 7 pages long. It has lots of sayings that are in Matthew and Luke, like a sower went out to sow, you know, the parable of the sower, or the parable of the mustard seed, or, you know, blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, sayings that are very familiar, are in it. And so some people thought, hey, maybe this is really the source that Matthew and Luke used when they wrote their Gospels.
And in other words, I was struck by the way you said it's only 7 pages long?
Yes.
I didn't remember that from Beyond Belief. But what you're saying is it is just like a book of aphorism, a book of sayings, and what those later Gospels, if following the chronology you're laying out, the others, was they added the story and the chronology and so on, and then put these sayings into that life story.
Yes, and scholars had always assumed that there would have to be lists of the sayings of Jesus quite earlier than the Gospels, because Matthew and Luke are written independently, we think, by different authors. And you asked who wrote them. The answer is we don't know. Those are traditional names, we add. But
and when those traditional names, is there any reason for them? In other words, is it that those who sort of felt themselves to be followers of John or followers of Mark ended up adopting the version that is then called the Gospel of John and Mark? Or what is it? Why do they have the names of people who obviously did not write them?
Well, they could have, but, you know, saying the Gospel of Matthew doesn't necessarily mean that the disciple Matthew wrote it. It could be. I mean, these are collections of each one, each gospel is a collection of sayings and anecdotes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it could mean the gospel the way my teacher Matthew taught it.
Yeah.
So it could have been that the followers of Jesus, you know, they told his sayings, we think, before they wrote them down. And that Matthew would have been a teacher, or John or James or other disciples of Jesus would have been teachers, probably preaching the word of about Jesus. And so they each had sort of favorite collections.
Mm-hmm.
And these gospels are different. It looks like the people who wrote Matthew and Luke used the same written collection. And we think that because there's a lot of the same sayings that occur in both of them. And Jesus spoke Aramaic, you see, Terrence, and these are written in Greek. So if you find Jesus saying the identical thing in independent sources in Greek, you have to think, well, they're not translating independently.
Mm, right.
So they probably have a written source, like these are the sayings of Jesus translated from Aramaic into Greek, and Matthew used them, or whoever wrote it used them, Luke used it, and the Gospel of Thomas has some of the same ones. So some people thought Thomas was earlier than the others. It was the original source. Now, I don't think that's necessarily the case at all. I think it looks like it draws on the same source.
Yeah.
But anyway, we don't know exactly when it would be written. But it looks most likely like the earliest of the texts that were found.
Okay, so again, I'm going to bring people up to speed here and then push this forward. I'm Terrence McNally. That's Elaine Pagels. She's the award-winning author of the Gnostic Gospels. We're talking actually about the evolution of things that lead to her newest book, Revelations, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. And I usually give out a website for guests if people want to learn more. In your case, there, other than your Princeton University one, you don't really have one, right?
No, I don't. No,
and
I don't.
What about that Nag Hammadi Library website?
Well, I haven't looked at it lately. There's probably a lot of good stuff on it.
And
I mean, these writings can be found there.
Exactly.
And some of them are poems, and some of them are, you know, the thing is, Terrence, these are writings that probably weren't meant to be part of a canon, because a canon is a list of things you're supposed to read in public worship.
Sure.
And these writings are really more mystical writings. They're sort of advanced level teachings. It's like, okay, you know about Jesus, you know that he was teaching in Galilee and he taught this and he taught that. But now I'll give you the secret teaching, and the Gospel of Thomas claims to be his secret teaching. Now, if he was like other rabbis, he did teach differently to advanced level disciples than to beginners. So this wouldn't be part of an ordinary canon. It wouldn't be what you'd have in a worship service. It would be what you'd give to advanced level disciples.
Mm-hmm. So once we find these books in Nag Hammadi, we now know that there were many gospels, there were many, as you say, more esoteric teachings, more the secret teachings, there were all sorts of things. And yet, I went to Catholic school, I knew that there were four gospels, there were a certain number of epistles, and this book of Revelations wasn't even that certain, I don't think, at that point. What's the political and cultural story of how that came down?
That's a good question. It's a great question, and it's one we've thought a lot about. By the way, I felt there was another question that might hover in the background of some people's minds, like, what is this like the Da Vinci Code? And I just want to say, the person who wrote the Da Vinci Code read about these secret texts, the real ones, and then sort of jumped off into historical fiction. But the real discovery is so much more interesting. Yes, what we find out now is that, and I wrote about this in the new book on Revelations, is that bishops debated, as long as Christianity was an illegal movement, there were lots of gospels and writings of Paul and other letters of other people and circulating between groups all over the world, from Rome to Africa to Spain, Italy, what is now Europe and England, all part of the Roman Empire, all kinds of Christians' writings. But in the late second century, some bishops said, well, I'll tell you, there's only four pillars of truth, and those are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I mean, the other Gospels are written, they're wrong. They're just heretical, they're weird. They called them illegitimate, literally, illegitimate. So they were disliked by some of the bishops. And when Constantine was converted to becoming a Christian in the 4th century, it was 312, he gradually transformed the Roman Empire, to everybody's shock, into a Christian empire. And when bishops became not sort of fugitives, hunted because they were part of an illicit religious cult, but because they were now allies of the emperor, money poured into the treasuries of the bishops. They became politically important, and they established a really organized church with creed, canon, and clergy. And canon meant you had to have a list that everybody agreed on of what were the right books about Jesus. So it's really not in 325, as some people think if they read the Da Vinci Code, but about 370, nearly the year 400, before there's actually a list that people began to agree on. So that's really late.
And is this the Council of Nicaea?
No, it's actually about 50 years after that.
Uh-huh. So Nicaea establishes the creed that these are the beliefs.
Exactly. Nicaea, they fight out a discussion of a creed, as you said, and then there's a lot of fighting after that to battle the people who don't accept it against the people who do, and the Orthodox win because they actually have the emperor's power on their side for the most part. And so, but the canon comes about 50 years later, at least, because between the years 350 and 400, there's huge debates about the canon. Now, people didn't debate about which Gospels belonged there. I think Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were read most commonly because they've got the stories in them. The others are not so easy to read. They're more mystical, and they're less known for the most part. Except in the early centuries, we think the Gospel of Thomas was widely read as the Gospel of Matthew, because if you look at the garbage dumps of Egypt, where you find the scraps of books that were shredded, you find as many pieces of Thomas as you do of Matthew, and very few of Mark, and just a few of John.
Okay, so he converts, it becomes the state religion, the bishops become authority figures rather than outlaws.
Right.
And it makes sense then that the most orthodox religious would have the alliance with the empire, being that they're the most authoritarian, correct?
Well, I'm not sure authoritarian is, I mean, it's one way to put it. They were the most organized.
Yeah.
What they did, they call their churches Catholic, because, which means universal, of course, as you know, because they established a network of churches that would communicate throughout the world, because they had leaders that would be authorized to write a letter on behalf of, say, our little church in France to your church in Rome, or your church in Turkey or Syria, wherever. And they organized it on the model of the Roman army. So just like the Roman army had, you know, ranks of officers, they worked out ranks of officers that they called bishops, priests.
Monsignors, cardinals.
Not that yet.
Yeah.
But just bishops, priests, and deacons. Mm. And then each one had a diocese, which meant, you know, a territory.
Mm-hmm.
Just like a general. If you were a general, you were responsible for keeping peace in a certain territory. And now a bishop would be responsible for a certain territory. So that all happens in the 4th, 5th centuries.
Mm-hmm. And what we see, yes, is that now we've got these two things that used to be mortal enemies aligning and modeling each other, and now we can go forward with what I always heard, the Holy Roman Empire.
Exactly.
Suddenly emerges. Is it pretty fair to say that when the decisions were made to what was the canon and what was not, I have two questions there. One is, was there a pretty clear difference? Was there something clear that, as you say, the ones that said, that's weird, that's not real, don't believe in that, versus the ones that came in? And then part and parcel with that was not just this is the canon, but everything else is to be destroyed?
Yes. Actually, we have about five lists of canons from between the year 350 to 400, and they disagree. They agree on a lot of things that are the basic writings that most people, by then, most bishops at least, accepted. The four Gospels of the New Testament, the letters of Paul, the other letters which probably Paul didn't write but were written in his name, and the book of Revelation was the most disputed. Some people said, absolutely doesn't belong. This is just, it's not a revelation, it's just crazy, it's irrational, it's John didn't write it, it's written by a heretic. And other people said, no, it's a real revelation, it's actually written by a disciple of Jesus. So there were more fights about that one than any other book in the canon.
How popular was it? You had said before that the four Gospels were the most popular. How popular at that point, at this controversial decision to include the Revelation, is the book of Revelation?
Well, it was both loved and hated, as it always has been.
Yes.
And
okay.
The people who loved it, I was very much interested in how did it get in and who read it. And the people who loved it, say, 100 years after the death of Jesus, were his followers who were being persecuted by Rome. They were being arrested. They were being tortured. If they said they were Christians, they were often killed. And even the magistrate said, well, I'm not sure what the crime is, you know, the governor of part of Turkey says, I didn't know what the crime was, but I thought they were so obstinate they deserved to be killed anyway. And the emperor sent a letter saying, well, you did the right thing. That's Emperor Trajan. And we have the correspondence. So this book was loved by Christians who were suffering that kind of suspicious, hostile response from the Roman Empire, because it's a book about the conflict between the forces of good and evil, and the Roman Empire is absolutely cast in the role of evil empire.
And as you point out, part of the staying power, part of the passionate popularity of the book of Revelation is very much that it is good versus evil, and Martin Luther uses it against the established Catholic Church. Established Catholic Church uses it against Martin Luther. Abolitionists use it against slavery, and I believe part of the genesis, if you will, of your researching this and writing this book was when you saw people using it to justify the invasion of Iraq.
That's right. It was being used then. Just as the operation that was called Shock and Awe, the bombing of Baghdad with American bombs, if you look in the book of Revelation, there are six angels who pour the wrath of God down on the earth. And the sixth angel, as whoever named that military operation knew, pours the cup of God's wrath right. It's a huge bowl of God's wrath. It's an enormous bowl. There's huge noise, explosions, lightning, thunder, and people on the earth die cursing God, right? And it sounds like bombs falling, and it's right over Baghdad.
Mm.
And so the delivery of those bombs over Baghdad was read by someone, I don't know who, as the delivery of God's wrath. And you know, that is a way to talk about war, to make it a moral imperative. That's what its advocates did. It was a war about, you know, the axis of evil, which naturally placed George Bush at the head of the axis of good.
Exactly, and very much plays into this. Now, this is Elaine Pagels. She's a noted religious scholar. Her latest book is Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation, which we were just speaking of. I do want to hit two other points prior to this one, which is that Adam, Eve, and the Serpent, the first book of yours that had a big impression on me, there's a crucial thing when I recommend this book to people, that there was a turning point in the church about humanity's relationship to nature, sexuality, and even man, the relationship of man and woman. And it was kind of up for debate, and that there were decisions made around this same time that led to the church adopting one view, one relationship, and denying the other as heresy. Could you talk just briefly about that? Because I find that so. Again, this is the book Adam, Eve, and the Serpent from 1988.
I was fascinated by that, Terrence, because my husband and I were visiting in the southern Sudan, and we were talking to the foreign minister of the Sudan then, who had published a book of creation myths of his people. He was from the Dinka tribe. And I was struck by how practical they were. They were about who you could marry and about what work people do and why people die. And then I realized that the creation myth in Genesis is just like that. It's very practical. And when it's mentioned in the New Testament by Jesus, only once, basically once, it's a question about sexuality. It's a question about divorce and whether it's legitimate. It's a question about, you know, the structure of marriage and sexual relationships. And that's the way the book was read. That's the way Genesis was read, and that's the way creation myths are read. And I was very much interested in the way we got sexual attitudes from everything about gay sexuality to abortion, contraception, all of the hot-button issues that have been so used politically, are read out of biblical sources and actually read, in some cases, out of Adam and Eve. I think you're talking about Augustine's view. Is that right?
Yes, Augustine. And there was an Augustine, who we know quite well, City of God, one of the, people that even non-Christians study. And the other, was it Julian?
Julian of Aquinum was the only man who dared challenge Augustine, who was a very famous, eloquent bishop, very powerful bishop, of course. And Augustine's view of humanity was that we were marred by original sin.
I mean, that's really his big contribution, isn't it? Original sin, fall from grace,
yes.
And original sin.
It isn't totally his invention, but he developed the idea of original sin, and he also developed the idea that you can prove that we all have original sin because we are mortal, we are subject to death, and because sexual desire does not occur in humans today according to will, but just spontaneously, and for Augustine, for reasons I find rather strange, this was considered weird. he believed that God would have created sexual desire for one rational purpose, since it's thought of as such an irrational activity, that how could you do it for anything but a rational purpose if you were a rational person? And that rational purpose, of course, would be procreation. Otherwise, there's no purpose, shall we say, at all. In Augustine's mind, affection, relationships, pleasure, these don't figure.
And just to throw in the personal here, Augustine had a period in his life where he quite indulged in the sexual spontaneous impulse in a non-rational way, and this was him turning against his own youth?
He talks a lot about his intense sexuality. And he regarded that as a source of sin, and this was not an unusual view at that time. So, but Julian of Aquinum protested and said, "No, this is part of the goodness of life. This is part of the blessing of life, and death isn't a punishment for sin. It's just a natural process like sexuality." And I thought to myself, "Could anything be more natural than sex and death? I mean, it's almost the definition of nature." But Augustine says they were the result of original sin. So I was very much interested in how that view became part of Christian theology.
And it is in this conflict, isn't it? And there is a decision made, and Julian is labeled heretic. And you point out, I think, that, and I remember at the time that I was reading this and the time that it came out, was very much the sort of the rebirth of the environmental movement in the late 80s, early 90s, that our whole relationship to nature is bound up in that decision as well.
Yes, and what I was trying to show in the book was, what interested me a lot was how much sexual attitudes had changed since I was in college, everything changed, attitudes about every aspect of sexual self-expression. You grow up and you think they're sort of built into the nature of the universe. And I realize that's because we were told that they were. I mean, they're part of the creation story. And so I began to think about how we got those attitudes, and how they got to sound so authoritative in that particular way. It's fascinating. I mean, the history of religion is very powerful, and it's very deeply built into the emotional structure of the way people in particular cultures respond to things, as you know.
The one other point I wanted to make from one of your other books was the that you talked about how the Gospel of Thomas, which it seems from my reading as a civilian, if you will, that of the new ones, I hear about it more as an accepted gospel than Mary Magdalene or Judas or that sort of thing, and that may just be, you know, that may just be baggage or whatever. But it's a very, as you point out, the Gospel of Thomas is a very mystical one, and there's that one wonderful quote which about if you bring forth what is within you, and I will let you say the quote because to me it is such a wonderful one.
That's why I wrote the book about the Gnostic Gospels. It was this quote. In the Gospel of Thomas, as we said, is just a list of sayings of Jesus, attributed to Jesus. And one of them is Jesus says, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. And I thought, wow, you don't have to believe that. It just happens to be true.
and true at such a deep, a deep level.
Absolutely.
And so that is the and one can imagine that as the cornerstone of a religious life or a religious approach to life is very different from, say, John's, who it seems to me is the dominant one among a lot of American Christians. John is about being born again and accepting Christ as your Savior and these those sorts of things, versus Thomas, which is very much that it is what is you and what is God is within you.
Yes, it is. It's not an accident that people love that one the best, and I do too, because it is really close to sayings that we know are sayings of Jesus. And the teaching of it is about humans created in the image of God. I mean, it's not esoteric in that sense. It's really what a lot of Christians believe instinctively. A lot of Catholics do, a lot of Quakers do, a lot of other people, that because we're created in the image of God, we have ways to find access to God within ourselves if we look for them. And so this book is all about this Gospel of Thomas, is one in which Jesus says, whoever seeks should not stop seeking till he finds, because when he finds, he'll be troubled, and when he's troubled, he'll be astonished. And it's about seeking within and finding one's way to the divine source which created us. And that's pretty powerful, and it's probably shared also with Jewish mystical thought. And if Jesus said these things, which he may have, he might have been very well acquainted with Jewish mystical thought.
And your point, you're mentioning Jewish mystical thought, not necessarily all of Jewish thought, but the mystical part. And it seems to me,
of course, it's Genesis that, you know, that God created humankind in His image. I mean, that's what Obama used in his speech. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that all people are created. He didn't use in the image, but that is in Genesis. But interpreting this as the primary element of human existence, I guess that's what you find in Thomas, and you do find it in Kabbalah and Jewish mystical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now let's shift to the Book of Revelation. You have called it the strangest, most controversial, least understood book in the Bible. We've already talked about how it was controversial even then, and controversial whether it would be included in the New Testament or not. The content seems to be different, not stories and lessons, but dreams, visions, nightmares. Why does it remain controversial, and why do you feel that its influence has survived and perhaps even grown?
That's such a good question. That's what I was asking myself. Controversial because there are no stories in it, there's no ethics in it, there's no narrative. All it is, as you said, are basically dreams and nightmares, and they're visions that a prophet named John of Patmos, who probably was not a disciple of Jesus, although later tradition assimilated him with one, said that he had about 60 years after the death of Jesus. And these visions are either horrific or they're very beautiful. They're basically an image of how he was taken up into heaven, as the Apostle Paul says he was also, and he saw the throne of God, and he was enabled to see the future, and the future that he envisioned was one in which God was going to come and recover the earth from the powers of evil that had taken it over with a huge cosmic battle, the forces of angels fighting against demonic, satanic forces in this huge battle which you mentioned, which is called Armageddon, right, the end of time, and that when it does, Jesus will come to judge the living and the dead, the world will come to an end, and a new Jerusalem descends from heaven. It's a very powerful set of images. I think that's one reason it survived. It's tremendously vivid and passionately written. Second, it's written by, as you said, a refugee from the Jewish war against Rome. He had lived in a terrible, terrible time of war. And this book is written with a passionate conviction that God will not allow the evil to rule the world forever, that God will bring justice in the end and transform the world and rule it in righteousness and glory, and God will light the whole world again. And that vision is a vision of hope for people who live in crisis and pain and agony, people who, you think about the people in Syria who see nothing but horrible destruction and devastation around them. And so this book is about, seeing the horrors of the world, of human action in the world, and yet hoping that there will be justice in the end. So it inspired people like Martin Luther King Jr., it inspired a lot of people who hope for justice. But because the images are so powerful and so elusive, I mean, images of, say, monsters and horrors, they're not very specific. So you can apply them on almost any side of the same conflict, as you said.
In other words, good versus evil. Our side is good. We are on God's side. Together, we will vanquish evil, and ultimately, we will triumph.
Exactly. And you can see, for example, in World War II, many people felt that Hitler was the Antichrist, the beast, the monster. And, of course, there was plenty of evidence for that. And you see a French prisoner of war, Gabriel Messiaen, writing in a German prison camp in 1941, The Quartet for the End of Time, which is his vision of the end of time, right out of the book of Revelation, a hope for survival, which he did survive, of course, that war. And then you can see a book about Nazi propaganda, in which Hitler is seen as the bringing in the third kingdom, the kingdom of Christ, purifying the world for Jesus, right? And this was read by the Nazis that way, and they taught it that way to Catholics and Lutherans.
So in other words, what you're saying is the Book of Revelation, or at least imagery from the Book of Revelation, themes, were played by both sides.
Exactly. And they were played by both sides in World War II. They were played by both sides, as you said, in the Civil War, both by the South and the North. The Battle Hymn of the Republic, which was also sung at the inauguration,
right,
is written right out of the Book of Revelation, because it was about the Union Army, and it was about God's, God's truth is marching on. And many people thought that the Battle of Armageddon was coming, that this was punishment for the sin of slavery, and yet people on the other side could read it too. And the reason they can do that is that the images, as I said, are what scholars call multivalent. They don't have one meaning.
Let me get to a couple of other things about this. One is your sense, because I've heard you say, I am a historian.
Yes.
As much as you're a religious scholar, you're a historian, is that John is writing about the Roman Empire.
John is...
John is a Jew writing about the Roman Empire. Later, of course, this becomes a part of the Christian New Testament, et cetera, et cetera. But, and your conviction for that, very briefly, is?
Well, John is certainly a Jew. He is immersed in the writings of the classical prophets, Isaiah, Daniel, Ezekiel, Jeremiah. He knows that literature. He doesn't speak Greek very well. He speaks the Greek of somebody whose native language is either Aramaic or Hebrew, but he's immersed in Hebrew prophetic literature. He's also a follower of Jesus. And John is definitely writing about the Roman Empire, and maybe he writes about them as monsters and whores because he writes about the empire as a monster because the prophet Daniel had used language like that. The prophets Ezekiel and others had spoken of Egypt or Babylon as Isaiah spoke of Babylon as a whore in Isaiah 43, or as Ezekiel saw the enemies of Israel as monsters, beasts. So he's using traditional language, but he's also using language that might avoid him getting into terrible trouble.
Exactly. The point we were just making, that the images are not specific, is partly he gets to express all of his rage and all of his hope, and yet he does it without specifically tying himself to anything against the Roman Empire.
Yes. I mean, it could be the danger of being a Jew who hates Rome as much as he does, writing this anti-Roman propaganda. So the number of the beast, 666, as many people have pointed out, is probably the name of the Emperor Nero in numerological code.
In other words, to people at that point, this would have been able to we would have been able to understand this because numerical code was known by people.
Jews who knew the prophecies
okay.
would get it.
Yep.
Not everybody would get
right.
it. And probably the Romans wouldn't get it.
And then the images of the seven-headed this and the multi-headed thing, that is also, as you point out, and we don't have time to go into it, but if you look at the huge artistic works of the Roman Empire at that time, the relationship of the empire to the women very often, that it was dominating was symbolic of the empire, dominant of Britain, dominant of Armenia, but in some ways you see that same sort of imagery is what shows up in the Revelation.
Yes, and of course, if you look on coins, the Roman coins will have the goddess Roma. Rome is imaged as a great goddess sitting on seven hills, you know, and ruling the world. And then if you take that and mix it up with Isaiah's image of Babylon as a prostitute, as a proud queen who's going to be dragged down to the dust and humiliated by God, then that's the way John sees Rome. He wants to say, well, yes, she may be a proud queen and she may think she rules the world, but she's going to be humiliated just the way Babylon has now been.
So I hope that we've whetted the appetite of listeners for a lot of these books and for this book. I'm going to ask you one final question. You have about a
sure.
minute or so to answer, okay?
I've had
Which
great
is that
questions.
I didn't recall Jesus making predictions. I, as I say, went to Catholic school. I've read this stuff a lot. But as you point out, he did predict end times and deliverance. He's quoted as saying, his people will be delivered in one generation. Well, what happened when that didn't happen, and how does that play into this?
That plays very deeply into it. In the Gospel of Mark, which we think is the earliest, the first thing he says when he comes into public view in Mark 1:15 is the kingdom of God is coming soon. Repent and believe in the good news. That's the good news. The kingdom of God is coming soon. The world is about to be destroyed and transformed. In chapter 13 of Mark, he says, the kingdom of God is coming soon. And then he says, it's coming with power, and some of you standing here will still be alive when it happens. So it's coming within a generation. And that was the expectation of the Apostle Paul, and that was the expectation of John. But he's writing 60 years later, and I think he's writing to keep hope alive that the kingdom is still coming. But it's that sense of urgency that for some reason still, 2,000 years later, inspires people.
Right. In other words, the fact that the prophecy doesn't turn out to be wrong, it either means the prophecy was wrong or you interpreted it wrong, and that is that open interpretation that is still alive today.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it was prophesied that the end of the world was coming last May, right?
That's right.
And then they said, well, maybe we didn't get it right.
And then there was the Mayan calendar ending, et cetera, et cetera. So
exactly.
That is part of the remaining power of the Book of Revelation. So again, the book is Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do both of those things either at iTunes or at my website. And my website has two names, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. And if you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues with three or four articles of background, sign up at my site or email me at T.E. McNally, T.E.M.C.N.A.L.L.Y, T.E. McNally at mac.com. And finally, thank you again to Elaine Pagels. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Believe it or not, one public official has actually stood up to the finagling banksters of Wall Street. 3 years ago, Jed Rakoff, the U.S. District Judge in Manhattan, stunned Citigroup by just saying no to a sweetheart deal it had cut with the Securities and Exchange Commission. The bank had been caught in an egregious case of ripping off customers by selling a mess of investments to them that the bankers knew would go bad. Sure enough, the customers lost $700 million, while Citigroup reaped $160 million from a side bet it made that the investments would indeed be worthless. Yet, even though the SEC had a solid case against the crooks, rather than taking them to court for proper punishment, the agency slapped them on the wrist with a $285 million fine, pocket change for the $14 billion a year bank. As is common in these sweetheart settlements called consent decrees, the SEC didn't even make Citigroup admit that it was guilty of fraud. Such decrees, however, have to be signed by a judge, and Rakoff was asked to rubber stamp this one. He refused. Like most Americans, he's appalled by Washington's coddling of Wall Street's too-big-to-fail, too-big-to-jail banks. So he demanded that the two cozy parties submit proof that this deal had any relationship to justice. Way to go, Jed! But rather than bother with such niceties as truth, Citigroup appealed Rakoff's ruling, and now he is the one being punished. The appeals court reprimanded Rakoff for demanding truth from a Wall Street bank, declaring that it was not in his judicial purview, quote, to demand cold, hard, solid facts. This is Jim Hightower saying, by getting the one guy who stood up slapped down, Citigroup and the SEC are claiming victory. But they actually lost any shred of public respectability they had left, while lifting our esteem for Judge Rakoff higher than ever.
Hate-fueled right-wing talk radio sits alone on the AM dial. The 10 million people a week who listen to it are influenced by its racist, misogynist, hateful messages. Recently, it deposed its own majority leader for being weak on immigration, when he was as strongly opposed to immigration reform as anyone, just not strongly enough for their friends in the Tea Party. If there is even a glimmer of good news associated with the powerful right-wing AM radio broadcasters, it is that their time is ending. AM is a dying medium, and its largely stale, pale, and male audience is going with it. It's just not happening fast enough. But we can hasten their demise. The Progressive Voices Network, that's the stream you're listening to right now, is a nonprofit source for thoughtful shows from Bill Press, Stephanie Miller, Tom Hartman, Sam Cedar, Mike Papantonio, Bobby Kennedy, David Pakman, Leslie Marshall, Mike Malloy, and more. But that's not all. Instead of the 17 minutes of local commercials that radio and satellite make you sit through every hour, on the Progressive Voices Network, you get commentary, humor, and newsmaker interviews, and the whole thing comes to you free in CD quality audio. It really beats the stuffings out of AM radio. And it's mobile. There's no need for a satellite subscription or a local affiliate, because the Progressive Voices Network is always on your computer, your tablet, your smartphone, and now automatically in your connected car. The only thing is, it's really expensive to eliminate all those commercials and replace them with Tara Devlin's two-minute tirades, the Green News Report, Shane and Danielle on the top of the hour, Giuliano Forlano's Absurdity Today, Jim Hightower, and all the rest. So please do what you can to help. Just point your browser at progressivevoices.com and click on the Support PV button to make sure all our Progressive Voices are heard. That's progressivevoices.com, Support PV. Thanks.